Anyway, this is the Right Dishonourable podcast. I'm Jimmy.
Yeah, and I'm John.
He's John, just taking a sip of water before I asked him to do that. And this week we are going to be talking about, he says, trying to change the tab so that he can read the topic list.
Corbo!
We're going to be talking about Jeremy Corbyn, or Corbo, as John is now referring to him, and his attitude to nuclear weapons, which is one of the many fun issues that has dominated this week's coverage of the Labour conference in Brighton. And second, we are going to be discussing the to-do at Warwick University regarding Mariam Nemazi, I think is how you pronounce her name. She was temporarily banned from speaking at an atheist society at Warwick University, which was then overturned after a lot of media coverage. And we're going to be discussing that because John actually is a student at Warwick University.
And if after this podcast I get ceremoniously or unceremoniously expelled, then you know why.
And as the third topic, we're actually going to be discussing something that happened. So I think it was just after we recorded the podcast, or just before. It was a news story about I don't want to say mob, that sort of just sounds like I'm exaggerating too much, but a small mob stood outside a cereal cafe in Shoreditch.
An unpolite gathering.
Indeed, and pelted it with paint and that sort of thing. And there's been lots of various discussions around gentrification in the Shoreditch area. It was supposed to be an anti-gentrification protest, but I think the actions of the protesters didn't endear them to the press, who were largely critical about this.
Maybe it wasn't actually about any of this. Maybe it was just that the Rice Krispies were too dry.
I mean, maybe.
It's not bloody like...
All of that will be revealed after the music stops playing.
So, this week, good old Uncle Corbo, Jeremy Corbyn, friend of the Right Dishonourable, or not, depending on how you look at things. Probably not, really, to be honest.
Probably not.
I mean, yeah.
We've generally run articles that haven't been too favourable towards him, although I sort of wanted him to win the Labour leadership because I thought it would make things more interesting from a democratic sort of perspective. I'm reconsidering this opinion, but yeah, go on.
I just said, I'm remembering the Thai article from this week as well. Right. I don't know what I would, anyway. So this week, Jeremy Corbyn was heard telling a BBC News reporter that under no circumstances would he ever use a nuclear weapon against another country, that he didn't agree with Trident, etc. To be fair, this is nothing new in terms of Jeremy Corbyn's views. He's been a long-time supporter of
the campaign for nuclear disarmament.
That's right, CND. So it came as no surprise. It was also, according to him, quite rightly on his mandate for election. However, does this make him unprime ministerial? So Jimmy, your initial thoughts?
So the question was, does it make him unprime ministerial that he doesn't?
Yeah, because a lot of the press are running with, well, now we can definitely never put him in 10 Downing Street because, you know, if anything goes wrong, he's never going to hit the button. So we're a pushover as a country now.
I don't really buy that as a piece of reasoning, because the point of having nuclear weapons is that you don't really intend to use them. Although I suppose you could always argue that you have to give the impression that you might use them.
Yeah, I think that's the key to the argument, is people are saying whether or not you would ever fire, because the idea basically for a lot of the situations surrounding Trident is, if we get blown up by, you know, there are sort of 10 nukes. I think it would take like roughly probably 3 nukes to destroy Great Britain, but somebody was talking about this. So obviously, like, nuclear weapons now are generally fusion devices, not fission devices, so they're much stronger than was ever used in World War II. So about 3 could quite happily knock out London and a lot of Greater London. Sorry, that's 1. Then 2, Manchester, and apparently 3 would, like, the other one would either be Edinburgh or Aberdeen, and that would knock out most of our centres for communication, we'd essentially have to surrender. Like, London alone would probably kill something in the region of like 9 million people, apparently.
So, but even that said, we like the way that the nuclear deterrent works in Britain is that they're all located on, is it three different submarines? Or is it
there's a nuclear power submarines. I don't know how many there are, but that supposedly they are constantly roaming the world with like a nuke ready to go.
I think one of them roams and one of them sort of stays near Britain. But when you're chosen as Prime Minister, one of the first things that happens is that you have to go into 10 Downing Street and write the, I think, what is called the letter of last resort, which is the instructions to the commanders of these submarines as to what to do if Britain is no more, basically. And I think past prime ministers have often ended up saying, I'll just piss off to the United States and, you know.
Supposedly there are only about four response. Like, nobody knows because they're top secret and classified, but supposedly there have only ever been sort of four different responses written, one of which is like, we're dead already, so don't, you know, kill other people just out of spite. just don't bother. Go off to one of our allies like Australia or the United States and put yourself under their control.
I mean, actually, we can't fire the nuclear weapons without the keys from the United States, because the nuclear weapons were manufactured by the United States under that proviso that they basically have a veto over whether we use them or not, which I suppose is another absurdity to this whole argument of which there are many.
It's going to make it really difficult when... you know, I mean, somebody nuts is going to end up in the White House soon enough. We've got Donald Trump making it.
But the other side of the argument, and actually about Jeremy Corbyn's principle that he doesn't want to continue paying for Trident and he wants Britain to become a non-nuclear state, it's got, you know, a fair bit of support in the UK. It's not quite as fringe an idea as some of his economic policies say.
No, it's actually in some ways a bit of a cross-party ideal, because there are members from every party who think this.
Yeah, and some people think that we shouldn't be using Trident, but we should still have a nuclear deterrent, but it should be a cheaper one and less expensive, which is personally my view. But even if we didn't have any nuclear weapons, we are still part of NATO, which means that if anyone attacks us, say, I mean, this sort of links into the whole argument about Ukraine, which used to be a nuclear power. And then America and Russia arranged a deal whereby Ukraine would abandon its nuclear missiles, or I think hand them back to Russia maybe. And in return, there was like a loose defense pact, which turned out not really to exist.
Yeah, so actually, just jumping in there quickly, Ukraine is a very interesting country to bring up, because one of the points made, I believe it was by... it was on Question Time this week, Margaret Thatcher's biographer, who you said was, you knew his name.
Charles Moore,
was bringing up the idea that Ukraine perhaps wouldn't have been invaded by Russia had they been a nuclear state. So what are your thoughts on that? Because he was comparing it to, he said, this is the reason we need to have something like Trident, is because otherwise we're going to become a sort of Ukrainian state and anybody can come and invade us whenever they want.
I think that the comparison is blatantly absurd, but
I mean, I'm not quoting him exactly. Like, don't sue me or anything. It's just, that was the gist of the conversation that he was part of on Question Time.
Well, if that was the gist of his opinion, then it is absurd, because Britain's part of NATO. We're part of the EU. We have a very close allegiance to America as well, which has the largest nuclear arsenal in the world. It's not, and no one's, just Britain's place geographically, we are not neighbours with any countries that hold significant animosity towards us. It is not a Ukrainian-Russian situation in any way. I think he's probably right, though, when he says that Russia would have found it far harder to invade Ukraine if Ukraine still had nuclear missiles. Because although I don't think the Ukrainian government would have done anything, that possibility, that faint possibility, would probably have been enough, or potentially would have been enough to.
So the argument around that, or conversation around that, spun out into a point somebody made, that apparently, I don't know what the sources are for this, so it might be completely erroneous. allegedly spokespeople for ISIS this week said that they were looking to procure nuclear weapons for use against the West, and they were quite happy to use nuclear weapons against the West.
Was that Syria, did you say?
No, that was ISIS.
Sorry, yeah.
So a point that was sort of being brought up was that you can't have somebody like Jeremy Corbyn wanting to be prime minister, because if you have people like ISIS who are saying this kind of stuff, you need to have a more sort of hawkish demeanour, regardless of what your personal views might be. You have to, as a representative of the UK, look as if you're ready to defend your people.
I'm not sure I buy that argument either. I think it's... there's just a presupposition that there's one particular point of view that is correct, and therefore if you don't have that point of view, you simply cannot be elected as Prime Minister of the UK. The UK is fairly is not really a constitutional country, in the sense that a lot of stuff, including the office of the Prime Minister, is actually established by convention rather than by anything that's been written down. And for people to make the argument that you have this particular view of things and therefore you cannot be, you know, allowed to actually represent people is just crazy, I think. I mean, I don't know if you feel the same way.
I think ISIS is a very... they don't really need a nuclear weapon to inflict damage, for one. And secondly, arguably having a nuclear device to fire back at them doesn't matter, because they're quite happy to die for their cause anyway, which is a, you know, it's a different mentality of warfare. Mutually assured destruction doesn't work if the other side's actually quite happy to be destroyed.
Well, actually, that was part of the argument that people made when they said Iran can't have nuclear weapons, because... I mean, Iran's a strange country in a lot of ways, in the way that it deals with Islam, but at the time, I can't remember the name of the president, but he was blatantly a Muslim fundamentalist, basically, and there was not this sense that, as you say, the mutually assured destruction thing, there wasn't a sense that that was actually going to be a deterrent for him. But then you could equally well argue, there's a lot of Christians in the US that talk about the end days and the apocalypse and what now, and you don't necessarily get the sense that they would mind that kind of scenario either. So, and America, as I said before, America has the largest nuclear arsenal in the world. So,
yeah, I mean, when you put it that way, that's pretty terrible. Well, we have actually had fundamentalist Christians in the White House as well.
Who are you thinking of?
Reagan apparently was a fundamentalist Christian, and both of the Bushes supposedly have been fundamentalist Christians.
I know that, yeah, well, Christianity was important for George Bush Jr. at least. I suppose it depends on your definition of fundamentalist, but he seemed...
Allegedly, all three of them have...
You're talking about Jeb Bush as well, or...
Oh, no, not Jeb Bush. So old Bush, young Bush, have all sort of said that privately or publicly that they thought creationism was a correct worldview.
Wow.
So
I should probably pause a moment to let that sink in.
And also that they've both all three of them, I think, have definitely gone on record to say that they believe the Bible is the exact word of God, including all of the fire and brimstone bit at the end, which talks about the end of days. So a bit worrying.
I mean, maybe we shouldn't really be worrying about Russia at this point. Maybe we've been looking the wrong way this entire time.
I mean, you say that, but Putin only got in because he's basically... blessed by the Russian Orthodox Church, so that's a bit of a complicated issue as well.
It turns out religion and politics are quite hard to disentangle when it comes down to it. Who would have known?
And on that point, let's segue into something vaguely about religion when we talk about Warwick and potential Islamophobia.
Okay, so this week there was a huge furore after it emerged that Warwick University Student Union had refused an application for somebody to come and speak at the Atheist Society. That somebody was Mariam Namazi, who is a former Muslim. She's a member of the ex-council of the British ex-council of Muslims, or the something like that. And she's a prominent anti-Islamist campaigner. She's written and spoken widely criticizing Islam. And basically, Warwick SU sent the Atheist Society a message saying, we're worried that she might cause incitement of hatred against Islam and against Muslims, where we've read some of her articles and they were, quote, highly inflammatory. And they raised these reasons, and then after a couple of weeks, these messages were posted online. The press got a hold of them, and there was a huge uproar, basically, because this woman is a human rights campaigner. She's criticised Islam for the bad things that Islam has done, and she's also a former Muslim herself. And after this all happened, Warwick SU reversed its position. It first hid behind kind of due process and that sort of thing, saying, oh, we hadn't had a chance to review the appeal or whatever. No final decision was made. So the criticism from the press is unfair. John, you're actually a member of Warwick University. So what do you make of all of this?
I think there are about three different issues at play here. I mean, firstly, it was a very, very quick turnaround. It was 24 hours, essentially, from this hitting the national news to them reversing the decision. Secondly, it's not clear who actually refused her permission to speak in the first place, whether it was the SU or the university itself.
The email to the Atheist Society was definitely from the SU, although in the screenshots that they posted online, which have actually now been taken down for some reason, the actual sender of the email was blanked out. It was sort of reported that it was from the SU.
Well, what's interesting though is that in their sort of unequivocal apology and reversal of the decision, the statement reads that neither the SU president nor senior SU staff were consulted as they should have been in the making of the initial decision. So that, I mean, senior SU staff is a very interesting phrase to use, because essentially there are only senior SU staff. I know.
When I wrote the piece, and this might be a mistake on my half, but I interpreted that as this decision has been made by someone junior who had the authority to make the decision. And they did send an email back saying her application's been refused. It wasn't your application has been submitted for review. It was declined. It was, you know, this is not happening.
So the SU is kind of like a bit of a political system, which anybody can see if they try and look this up. So essentially you have the sabbatical officers who are they're the elected officials, really. That's people like the president, the welfare officer, people like that. Then you have some sub-officers who work on more specific things, who again, I believe, are all elected. And then you kind of have the staff at the SU who are sort of what you might think of as civil servants. So it's really strange to say that senior SU staff weren't consulted, nor was the SU president, because you kind of wonder who in this case did make the actual decision. It's very unclear.
See, I interpreted the kind of final decision thing as, I mean, I think I even just said it earlier, it was a way for the SU to hide behind, you know, it's like, oh, we haven't made a final decision, and therefore try and kind of spin it to make it look as good as possible. I don't think, if this issue hadn't been reported on in The Guardian, The Telegraph, The Independent, and so forth, that they would have reversed their decision. I don't think that would have happened.
I mean, the university is incredibly left-wing in general. It's you can easily be fooled into thinking it's not, because it's a very corporate university. We have an awful lot of links with different companies, which I think the university are quite proud of, because it means, you know, their employment rate is very, very good. However, you know, although there's that sort of more economic conservative thing going on, socially it's incredibly liberal. They have a very strong history of protests. I mean, when I was there, every fucking year there was something in the national press about, you know, either a gigantic sit-in or, you know, a movement that had started up there, or you know, something else. People were sort of living in tents. At one point, people were living in tents outside the Warwick Arts Centre and Senate House. It was a massive protest.
You mentioned this culture of protest, but I'm also kind of interested in how this story fits into a number of different stories from different universities about banning stuff because of fear of incitement of hatred or fear of causing offence. In the original email that apparently Warwick SU sent to the Atheist Society, they said that, I'm trying to remember the exact wording. It was something to the effect of, instead of insulting, actually I've got the quote here. There with me 2 seconds. It says that speakers, quote, must seek to avoid insulting other faiths or groups within a framework of positive debate and challenge.
So this is why I was bringing up the protest idea, because you said about, you know, if it hadn't reached the national news, would there have been... I think there would have been an upset about it regardless, which I think potentially could have overturned the decision anyway, because there is a big protest contingent at Warwick. But the reason I was bringing this up is because... actually, I think this whole decision to not let her in the first place is possibly linked to new government guidelines about this, because as it's been reported in the media, and I think the National Union of Students, if I'm correct, have condemned the new guidelines from the government and largely said that they don't advocate following them. You're not allowed to bring in what are deemed hate speakers.
Yeah, but I mean, hate speech is one thing, but I mean, the quote I just read out is about insulting people, and the way that hate speech legislation is written in this country, there is actually an explicit provision that you are allowed to insult and belittle and demean religion when you are criticising that religion. And there's obviously a recognition that in criticising that religion, you might end up writing stuff that would in other circumstances be classified as hate speech.
Well, the thing is that people are trying to shy away from talking about Islam in universities in general. This is the essentially what universities are doing, because what they're having to do because of the government. The government don't want extremists talking at universities. Without extremists to talk at universities, no self-respecting university is going to hold a debate on extremism or Islam without supporters of extremism and Islam talking in some way.
Yeah.
So you end up just not having any debates. So I kind of think it's smoke and mirrors, really, to talk about not wanting to insult people. I think it's essentially a very diplomatic way, perhaps, of saying, look, you know, our hands are essentially tied. We're not going to get into debates about Islam at the university. Therefore, this woman can't come. And interestingly, off the back of this, the Islamic Society at Warwick have said that they hope the same freedom of speech ideas are applied to them, which I'm not saying for a second suggests that they want to start inviting extremists along. But I think they're probably saying, you know, they want to be able to engage with people who might have what are considered radical views, which flies completely in the face of what the government guidelines have said.
I mean, I wonder if the way this story has been written up by... There was an article in the Spectator, I think, and they've certainly run this line before, is that there's now a culture of wrapping students in cotton wool when it comes to offensive ideas and inflammatory ideas. Do you think that... I mean, in the past, we've heard about, like, people campaigning to ban that song Blurred Lines by Robin Thicke, which a lot of people say the lyrics are quite rapey. This has happened at a number of universities.
It's actually happened at Warwick, I believe.
Okay, and there is this argument that what's happening right now is censorship is being imposed on campuses largely by student unions, and it's demeaning the quality of intellectual discourse at universities, which in turn has an impact on how the rest of the country discusses things, however minor or major you might think that is. Do you think that's true?
Right, so very controversially, about a year ago now, a student was expelled from Warwick for having fascist views. A Sunday Mirror thing had sort of rumbled him and found out that he was actually a young leader of the National Action Movement, which is basically kind of like a neo-Nazi idea.
Right, okay.
And he was removed from the university, and he hadn't done anything on campus per se. He hadn't incited any hatred on campus. He was removed sort of as a precaution from the university. And people like me kind of disagreed with it on the basis that how was he ever going to reform his views if he was just sort of excised from a place where he could be reasonably challenged in what was for him as well a safe environment. Because by just getting rid of him from the university, he's surely only going to go deeper into his views, and that was going to spiral out of control. So,
but it seems to me more that it's just a basic attack on freedom of thought.
I mean, the problem is they have a security risk issue at all universities, because you're dealing with people who, yes, technically are legal adults, but let's face it, students aren't able to look after themselves. So you're dealing, and you don't want violence happening on campuses and stuff like that. So if you do get people with extreme views, I understand that it's a worry for the university from a security point of view, but you're quite right. At the same time, people go through many radical different views. I mean, I've had run-ins with different people.
Are we going to refer to this incident?
Let's not really, but I've had run-ins with people over different issues where, you know, even what you would consider quite progressive groups turn out to be quite violent. So you're right. It does fall into a problematic, you know, territory of, is this sort of freedom of thought infringement? And I think universities have to be very careful about that. I think evidently they're not dealing with ideas like this very well at the moment. I think you could quite easily argue that, you know, would this have happened back in the 90s, sort of pre 9/11? Probably not. There wouldn't have been as much of a concern about it. But then again, we had a slightly different, maybe more patriotic culture back then anyway. The world's fucked, basically.
Okay, well, I think that's probably all that needs to be said. Actually, there's one story I just want to pass on before we wrap this up. There's a writer called Brendan O'Neill who's the editor of The Spiked, which is a kind of... libertarian, left libertarian magazine, and O'Neill also writes for The Spectator, and he wrote a piece over the weekend where he was speaking at Trinity College in Dublin. Trinity College is probably it's the best university in Ireland, or it's the most prestigious university in Ireland.
It's as old as Uxbridge, apparently.
There you go. And he was speaking about the Charlie Hebdo attack, and he was saying how at this debate... O'Neill was saying how the attack was obviously disgusting and people should be allowed to write what they want as far as criticism of Islam goes, and one of the opposition speakers stood up and said how Charlie Hebdo was a racist magazine, how it was, you know, just written by bigots, etc., and how what O'Neill reported was that this speaker said that they had it coming, basically. And apparently a lot of the students then cheered, or a lot of the people who were watching then clapped. What do you make of that?
I mean, actually, so this actually, there's just, why you've been talking about that, I've thought of an angle of this that we haven't really spoken about. Responding to that, like, students similarly at Warwick apparently have been campaigning against Miss Namazi.
Namazi, yeah.
Namazi coming along to speak because they consider her an Islamophobe. And that is a huge thing at Warwick. You can't be an anything. Like, so in answer to your question about Trinity, I think that there are people who definitely believe that. Dave Chappelle made a very good joke about it, which I go look it up on YouTube if you can find it, where he basically said that, you know... these people aren't known for being the most relaxed the relaxed group. Like,
he's referring to Islamists then rather than the Charlie Hebdo writers.
Yeah, he was basically, he kind of said the same thing, that maybe the Charlie Hebdo writers had it coming because, you know, if you attack extremists, they're not known for very moderate responses.
But I think his view is more, maybe you shouldn't do this for fear of your own personal safety, as opposed to the view that was... the view of this speaker almost appeared to be, oh, these Charlie Hebdo writers, not only did they get what was coming, but they deserved it. They deserved to actually be attacked and be killed for what they said.
Well, and that's a more extreme version of students at Warwick saying that this woman shouldn't be allowed to come and speak because, you know, what she's speaking out against religion is Islamophobic. And that sort of, that's a complicated issue because it actually buys into what I was talking about earlier, Warwick being a very left-wing university. Because there are cases like, you know, Post is in one of the student-run cafes, got banned a few years ago because they were deemed to be sexist. They were actually just trying to follow the vintage trend of, you know, people really loving sort of pin-up poster type things that year. And it was like pin-up poster cartoon women holding like their new drinks, and Warwick went nuts about it and said, you know, it's objectifying women. It was clearly just following like a trend in marketing, but you know,
on the Islamophobic point, the trouble with it is that it becomes very hard to distinguish between criticism of Islam and then sort of incitement to hate on Muslims, say. And it in even philosophically speaking, it's actually quite hard to differentiate those things, because obviously to a certain point, if somebody believes something that you think is despicable, it kind of makes sense that you also think they're despicable. I mean, whether or not that, you know, whether or not you think they should be beaten up in the street, that's entirely separate. But you can easily see why all of these issues become conflated, and it's very hard to separate them.
I think when you talk about, I think the key thing, I was watching a very good video done by a transsexual, transvestite in Dublin at their Abbey Theatre. It's talking about, you know, gay rights and everything over there. And he was talking very continuously about the fact that being somebody who was discussed, like, but part of a group that was discussed on state, you know, television all the time, and it, being somebody that was sort of regularly lectured to by heterosexual people, he felt oppressed because his views were never considered, the views of like the group he was part of were never considered. I think that's a kind of key to the Islamophobia argument. If, you know, so I think in that sense the Islamic Society were very clever to say what they did, because if you have a call and response to these kind of things, I think that's healthy and I think it keeps things going. If you only ever have one side of the argument, then you're biased either way. And I think you can argue that, you know, a society or institution or whatever is Islamophobic if you only ever have people knocking Islam. And I think it's very, very important to make a big distinction between
I wouldn't say they're Islamophobic purely for knocking Islam, but I do think you're right that, I mean, if you're at university, you should have people who speaking who think that, say, ISIS are onto the right idea, I think. You should have people who are actually willing to put forward that case and for it to be considered.
I mean, if you don't have that, because I think that's quite an extreme view and you'd probably have MI6 all over your case. If you don't have that, I think you should have people who talk about the cultural reasons behind why ISIS exists, you know, and just talk about it in like an education, because it's very easy to demonize these people and just say whatever David Cameron was heard saying, that, you know, they're this backwards death cult. It doesn't,
I mean, that they are a backwards death cult.
No, I mean they are, but at the same time you need to look at where this comes from in terms of culture, you need to look at what this is a reaction towards, and you need to look at whether there are any of their views that hold any resonance or are right, because so many people wouldn't be leaving the UK to go join them if there weren't certain ideas that resonate. A big part of their marketing campaign supposedly has been, look, the West hates you, you're a Muslim, just open your paper this morning, there's going to be something about you that says you're a terrible person. And although you and I might think that's not true because we're atheists, if you're Islamic, you might well open the paper every day and think, oh great, I'm being attacked yet again.
I mean, I agree with what you're saying about the educational value, but I just the moral point that you should actually be able to put forward, you know, put forward ideas that people don't like. So if you want to, I mean, moving away from Islam, if you want to argue, for instance, that, I don't know, Britain was a better place when, you know, women stayed at home and men went to work. If you want to argue that, I think you should be able to argue that. And I don't think people should sort of crowd you out just because you're a social conservative or what have you.
I mean, I agree because it covers freedom of speech. I think the problem is when you get into things, ideas like hate speech, and that's what this woman's views have been conflated with.
I think hate speech, it's not illegal to hate somebody. Why should it therefore be illegal to encourage somebody to hate something?
I mean, that's a difficult question, because actually what's to say that progressives talking about human rights aren't advocating hate of intolerant people? Which there's some merit to. You know, if you're a left-wing person and you say that everybody has equal human rights, etc., which is obviously something I vehemently agree with, implicitly you're saying that, you know, skinhead National Front type people are disgusting and we should all hate them. Yeah. In fact, a famous thing, like, not famous, it's like an idiom, I suppose, amongst progressives is, oh, I'm tolerant of everything except intolerant people. I mean, that when you think about it, that is hate speech in itself, saying that you...
Yeah, I mean, I would say it is, but then I would also say there's a difference between hating something and thinking that, you know, they should be beaten up in the street. Or, sorry, hating someone and thinking they should be attacked, like physically attacked. And there's, you know, there are some things in life that are worth hating, and there are some people who are worth hating.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to spend time hating people like Hitler, I suppose.
Just block out, you know, a couple of hours every week, maybe.
Yeah, just, you know, spend a little while just, you know, looking at a picture of him throwing darts at it or something.
All right, and on that helpful suggestion from John, I'm sure, Pete, I'm sure you have your own views. If you want to comment, you can go on the website, you can review us on iTunes as well, or you can get in touch via Twitter. So last Saturday, a kind of an anarchist group, I guess they describe themselves as, called Class War, organised a demonstration in Shoreditch, and hundreds of people turned up to this demonstration, and a number of them peeled off from the main demonstration and went to stand outside this cafe called the Serial Killer Cafe. And this cafe is, as implied by the name, its main distinction is that it sells bowls of cereal. And if you're listening to this from abroad, in Britain, it is not a normal thing to be able to buy cereal in a restaurant or in a cafe. That doesn't really happen.
I think it is anywhere. Where, like, I don't think you go to France and, oh yes, would you like a bowl of cornflakes in the mornings? That would cost you €3.
I think actually on the continent, they do have more of a, like, a breakfast cafe culture. Like, you can go out and buy breakfast and they sometimes will sell cereal. But anyway, it's not a normal thing in Britain.
Weirdos.
And Class War was standing outside the Serial Killer Cafe. The group that Class War had organised. The actual name of the protest was Fuck Parade. A number of them, yeah, it was literally Fuck Parade. Just thought I'd drop that in there. John's die with laughter right now.
Why? What's that got to do with cereal? Was that specifically for that event?
No. Fuck Parade is a series of events organised by Class War where they go. And
have orgies, presumably have orgies.
I don't think any sex is actually involved. But anyway, this group of people were standing outside the Serial Killer Cafe and they started throwing paint at it, and one of them wrote the word scum in felt-tip pen on the window. And there's actually, you can go online, there's a video of taken by one of the cafe owners from inside the cafe as it's being attacked, and apparently there were some children in the cafe that they moved into the back because they were becoming scared. And there's a video where he's talking about the protesters and he says, I'm worried they're going to smash the window. And eventually the police came in and moved on the protesters. And the ostensible reason that the protesters targeted the Serial Killer Cafe is because they're angry about the gentrification of Shoreditch. Shoreditch used to be a very scummy, poor area of London. Increasingly, it is occupied by hipsters. And the Serial Killer Cafe has been seen as, like, a poster child of hipsterism. Like, if you see a picture of the guys who own it, they have, like, the classic hipster beard. And it is quite a hipsterish thing, going out and paying for cereal at a cafe. So John's not heard this story at all before. John, what is your immediate reaction?
Right, okay, if you're the kind of twat who's going to pay whatever it is, what did you say the top price for a bowl of cereal was?
So I've seen various prices quoted. I think £2.50 is the low range, £3.20 is mid, and then £5 is the high range.
Right, so anybody who goes there is basically a fucking idiot. if you're the kind of, I mean, surely that's punishment enough. They don't need graffiti on the outside of the shop telling them that they're fucking idiots. If you're paying at least £2.50 for some fucking cornflakes.
Wait. It's not just like your bog standard cereals. It's like all types of novelty cereal, you know, limited edition. And
I don't give a shit. It could be a one-of-a-kind only pack of Lucky Charms from America that nobody will ever have again because it, you know, it was a mistake and the marshmallows weren't in the shape of clovers, they were in the shape of penises or something. I don't care. I really, you're a dick for paying that much.
I don't see that it's any different from going out to like a pub and paying £5 for a beer when you could buy like probably a 10 pack even of beers. Of the same beer and just drink it at home. I don't see how it's any different.
I'll tell you why you're wrong. So the pub is like a nice, you know, institution where you go and have a chat with your local neighbours and whatever. Who's going to do that with fucking cereal?
All right, mate. Good to see you this morning. Oh, did you see the news last night? Fucking hell. I tell you what, though. I really like these cornflakes. Mmm. It really makes everything all right, don't it?
Okay, but it's not that different for a coffee shop either, is it?
Nobody has ever said, oh, we bonded over a bowl of cornflakes.
I don't know. I'm sure, you know, some people have... Maybe great romances in the future will have started at cereal cafes.
If you've woken up with somebody in your bed and you're like, oh my God, I don't remember this, who are you? Then yeah, perhaps you can bond over a bowl of cornflakes because it's the first time you've realised there's another person there, but no. No.
Okay, but even if we're not having or you're not having the cereal cafe, they still have a right to set up a business without being molested by a small mob, right?
Yeah, no, definitely. It's actually just not a very appropriate protest. I mean, if you're gonna have a go at a serial killer cafe, I think of something clever, like, I don't know.
Maybe throw some cornflakes at them.
Throw some cornflakes at them. Or do something that would be really annoying, which is, like, get those... This would be way too complicated, though. I'm realising, as I say it, why they wouldn't have done this. But so in a night, like a utopian world, you just set up a little stool outside, get a nice little gas stove, bowl of water, then within that, a bowl of chocolate. And you're melting that chocolate while you're boiling the water in the bowl of water, and then... You add in some cornflakes and you start to get these clumps of like hot chocolate-fied cornflakes. You throw them at the windows. They're going to dry in the cold air. You've got fucking crusts of cornflake chocolate stuck to the windows.
See, having thought about, I think what they could do is maybe make some of those like really tasty Rice Krispie like biscuits things. You know what I mean? Yeah. And then just go outside the serial killer cafe and just start handing them out for free. You're undercutting their business, but at the same time, you're, you know... It's the spirit of anarchy and freedom and, you know, socialism.
Just pints of gone off milk would have been perfect. Just chuck like however much, because that's not hard to do either. Like you go out and pay a couple of quid for a few big cartons of milk and just leave them for a few weeks.
Yeah, imagine taking that on the tube. That's grim.
No, they're closed up, so you're not going to notice the difference, are you? It's only going to explode when it hits the impact of the... Mind you, that... Well, no, they're throwing...
I think we are right now suggesting ways of, you know, vandalising a property. I want to make it quite clear that we don't actually approve of this sort of thing.
I'm not sure. I'm basically saying to fuck parade, it was a missed opportunity. Go back and throw rotten milk and then this will be...
For legal reasons, no. This is not good. But actually, do they have a point that like bits of London are becoming, you know, poor bits of London are being gentrified and the original inhabitants are getting pushed out by hipsters with beards who eat cereal at cafes?
So I don't know about the original inhabitants getting pushed out, but so my dad's a Cockney from the East End. I mean, when is gentrification a bad thing? If you told me that like in a year Croydon's going to be gentrified, great, because at the moment it's a fucking shithole.
But where do these poor people go? Because they were originally living in these communities. A lot of people quite like living in the same area for their whole lives, and then they're just being pushed out. They have to go live somewhere else, maybe not with their friends and family who might be living in the same area. Is that not unfair?
Not really.
Wow.
No, I'm kidding.
I mean, that's but it's not like Shoreditch being gentrified is a new thing. I'd understand if it was, so if it was in an area like Croydon, where just out of the middle, you know, middle of nowhere, this was popping up and overnight it was becoming very rapidly gentrified, I'd understand. But Shoreditch has been gentrifying for years, like in a very big way. It's not like hipsters with beards being there has happened in 2015. I mean, it's been happening for at least the past 3 years. So I don't get why this, of all things. If you walk around Shoreditch now, there are loads of cafes that wouldn't have been there a few years ago. There are really expensive fashion shops, like prohibitively expensive, even if you're upper middle class. So I don't really get why a cereal shop is the one that really tips the balance for this.
Well, some people sort of made the argument that they should have like gone down to Canary Wharf or somewhere and like protested outside one of the big banks or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to protest, I don't think that protesting about gentrification is ever worth it, because I mean, all areas, you see this in London all the time, areas go through like these boom and bust cycles. There'll be these really posh areas for a while, then they're dip down and nobody will invest in them and there'll be shitholes, and then somebody...
Does that happen?
No, it does. It totally happens. I mean, when you look at the history of different... So Croydon, for example, used to be a real shithole, then it got a lot of investment from the... Croydon used to be really, really nice, then became a shithole, then got lots of investment from the Whitgift Foundation, became like a shopping centre, fairly nice again. Now has slipped back down to somewhere that you don't feel safe walking through, so... there are boom and bust cycles. I mean, Brixton, famous, everybody used to think was like a no-go area. Now it's quite trendy. I'm sure there's nothing to stop it in a few years being left behind because of areas like Shoreditch and Hackney, and it becoming yet again a not very nice area. So I don't think there's a point getting too angry about this. I think these boom and bust cycles just happen in urban areas.
But equally, while the bus cycle, or sorry, while the gentrification is happening in a given area, and actually more widely in London, the cost of living has become a huge problem over the last decade, so much so that like the cost of housing is going to be probably the central issue in the upcoming London mayoral election next year. This is happening, and while, you know, in a few years time maybe Shoreditch becomes not so trendy and then it becomes poorer again relatively speaking, people still have to live in those years, don't they? They still have, their lives are still ongoing. Yeah, they can't be put on hold.
Yeah, but this is the thing. Yeah, of course they have to still live, but they don't have to go buy a fucking £3 bowl of cereal, do they? I mean, if you're one of the people who's being hit really hard by things like credit crunch, recession, redundancy, whatever, you're not one of the people who's going to be frequenting those shops anyway, so.
I agree, but it's more a wider point about affordability in that, you know, in that area.
The sad truth is London's just not an affordable place. If you're looking for somewhere affordable to live, I understand people are angry about it. I think it's something, you know, the housing market's ridiculous. If the first time buyers in London have absolutely no chance, and I understand people being really angry about that. I mean, the easy answer is just don't live in London and move out, which I understand is not an option for most people. And I understand that, you know, there aren't good enough provisions by councils for housing and everything. I understand all of, like, housing and standard of living in terms of, like, where your money goes. This is why they've introduced a living wage and why supposedly it's going to be higher for London, is because it's impossible to live in London in terms of money unless you're in a really good job. I understand all of the anger about that, but I don't understand why that translates to fucking up a cereal shop.
So you think the government should be doing more to actually help those people that are affected by gentrification then?
Yeah, I think even the Conservatives have admitted that they need to help sort out, you know, things for first-time buyers, etc. I might be wrong on that, but I think that's a Conservative policy that they want to... No, it is. Cause
I think the first-time buyers thing is more directed at yuppie couples, I think. I mean, it was explicitly pitched as... You're a couple, you're just thinking of buying your first home, we're going to allow you to set up an ISA and we will subsidise that ISA. So if you put in, I can't remember what the exact figure is, but if you put in a couple of grand, the government will also top you up by exactly the same amount, which will therefore allow you to have a deposit to put down your first house and take out a mortgage, basically.
I mean, the other angle to this in a very cynical John vein, though, is I mean, people moan about standards of living all the time, and when you look at, I see, I'm aware this is dangerous territory and somebody's going to come kick my face in for this, but I do think there's an argument that people get greedy about their standards of living. Like, see,
I think some of this isn't so much about, because I assume you're about to say standards of living get better all the time over time.
No. I'm about to say things like everybody aspires to have a house in the UK. Like, we have a housing shortage because everybody wants a house. What's wrong with living in an apartment? You don't hear about people aspiring to live in apartments because we have like this very idealized mentality where you just want to grow up, get a house, you know, have a little fence around it and a dog and a wife and, or, you know, husband or whatever.
But those are probably like the people we like. Those are our class of people. But if you're, but there are some people who it's not about having a nice house, it's about having anywhere to live at all.
No, see, I agree with your point, but I think you're wrong in that I don't think it's our class of people. I think this is a British thing. I think British people just want this nice, you know, over idyllic standard of living, and I think you know, we've got to be realistic about things. We have a huge population increase. It's only going to get worse in the foreseeable future. I think people have to step back for a second and think, do we all really need houses? Like, if, for example, if I had a house, it'd be a joke, because I'm single. I'm not single.
Controversial.
Let's cut that.
I mean, you have a girlfriend who's currently at university.
I have no dependents, is what I mean. I have no dependents, and I'm a young 20-something. I don't need a house. I mean, I need a box at best, with like a bed and, you know, somewhere to cook things. Really, I need what, two rooms? Okay, two rooms and a toilet, maybe. You could condense that potentially to one really well kitted out room with a sink and, you know, whatever. But people don't think that way. People kind of, even when they think about flats, people think, well, you know, I want a lounge area, and I want a cooking area, and an entertaining area would be nice, and I need at least two bedrooms and things like this. And you sort of step back from people aspiring to these things and think, are you thinking this because it's genuinely what you aspire to, or are you just thinking it because you're told to aspire to it?
I mean, but is it not true that it would be a worse country if everyone lived in a shoebox, basically, which is kind of what you're suggesting?
Would it, though?
Because... I mean, but isn't there something to be said for humans actually, although in theory you can think, okay, what do I actually need? Kitchen, bed, toilet. Okay, what's the smallest conceivable amount of space that we can fit all those things in? But people actually do need space, don't they? It's a psychological impulse to actually want to have bigger things, and it does actually affect your overall well-being when you don't have those things.
It's a psychological impulse because essentially we're animals, and we're not made to live indoors, and we're kind of trying to domesticate ourselves to the point where we can do anything indoors, and there's just no point. If you're spending all of your day at home indoors, you're not really living life to the full. We've got way off topic here. I mean, no, essentially, I think that I empathise with people who are angry about gentrification. At the same time, I think it's a boom and bust cycle, and I don't think it's going to go away anytime soon. I don't think it's vandalising shops is going to help either. If you're going to have a go at anybody about it, have a go at government or the private sector. Don't bother people with, you know, fucking stupid cereal shops.
Okay, and on that note, do you agree gentrification is a good thing? Is it a bad thing? Should the government be doing more to fix it, or is it okay? How much do you dislike John right now for what he said? Send in your comments via all the usual things, and we'll actually be back next week. This time with Jazza, who is returning from his travels in the Far East. So yeah,
done.